everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, was heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on tithing versus income tax when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values. And that's because these two programs encompass the second and eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. And these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We covet our neighbor's property, and then we're taught to call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve notes, and we practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods that we call government. And we're not getting away with these crimes either. We now pay up to 75% of everything that we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by savings and loan companies. We drive cars owned by GMAC or by Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four now has a $70,000 consumer debt. We owe an $8 trillion national debt. We're surety for another $49 trillion of unfunded government obligations. Our financial institutions are leveraged out to around $100 trillion worldwide in derivatives. Our Social Security retirement system is a chain-letter Ponzi scheme, and we live from paycheck to paycheck. And then we're taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, the God of Israel gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers followed a better way of life. In our Constitution, we find these 17 words: no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Why don't you call right now? The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing of tithing versus income tax. We got a letter here the other day. Let me read it to you again. It's very short and to the point. It says, we have been reviewing the tithing scriptures. All of these scriptures we see are related to agricultural products or herds, flocks, and cattle. Where in the scripture does it say that a tithe is paid on all increase? And then where in the scripture does it say that labor is an increase? And third, if I exchange my labor for wood, isn't that a property exchange, and how did I increase from that? And we have answered those three questions. However, in answering those three questions, we raised some other questions. One of those questions that we raised is, where are these Levites that the law requires us to pay that first tithe to? Whatever happened to them, and how did that system work? Well, in the book called Symbols of Our Celto-Saxon Heritage, written by W.H. Bennett, in chapter 13, where it talks about the emblems of the priesthood and the civil service, remember I mentioned that the Levitical priesthood was, in ancient times, the equivalent of what we call today the civil service, the people that deliver the mail. the people who protect us, the policemen, the people who put out the fires, the people who run the bureaucracy of the city halls and all of the political apparatus that build our highways and run our transportation systems and commerce and trade and so on down the line. In short, in America, we call them the bureaucracy or the bureaucrats. Well, now, in the emblems of the priesthood and the civil service, in the biblical record of the organization of the Israel people into a nation, we read that the tribe of Levi was chosen for a special purpose. They were to be the priests and the civil servants of the nation. They were not given a province of their own, as the other tribes were, for their duties required that they live among the people and of all of the other tribes. Furthermore, they were not required to perform any military service. Consequently, though retaining their tribal identity for ordinary purposes, they were not considered as one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Nevertheless, having duties to perform as well as considerable authority, which they would have to exercise at times, they would of necessity require some uniform or insignia to identify them. What then was the emblem of the tribe of Levi, and therefore of the priesthood and the civil service of ancient Israel? I want to break in here and point out that today our firemen, our policemen, our military all wear uniforms. They all have a badge or insignia, and the policeman wears a badge, the fireman wears a badge, and this identifies them as civil servants. Well, the Israelites, the tribe of Levi, in ancient times, wore a badge. They had an emblem. We'll see what that is. Today, it's typically a star, or it's a shield. In ancient times, they wore a breastplate. Now, in our study of Israel and the tribal emblems, we saw that in giving his dying blessing to his sons in Genesis chapter 49, Jacob mentioned each of them in connection with some object, some animal, or personal characteristic, and this then became the heraldic emblem of that son and of that tribe descended from him. Now, in the case of Levi, however, the object mentioned in connection with Levi is the same as that of Simeon. It was a sword. And this was evidently appropriated by Simeon because we have been totally unable to find any evidence that it was ever used by Levi. In following the biblical story in search of evidence pointing to what Levi's emblem might be, we should keep in mind that the Israel people were brought into being to be God's own kingdom nation. With God as their king and their lawmaker, they were, in fact, the kingdom of God on earth. Consequently, with the whole nation being his kingdom, and with his laws applying to every phase of its life, both religious and civil, it follows that those who served God in either a civil or religious capacity were his ministers or priests. As such, they would require an emblem which would express this relationship. So where in the Bible, while the Bible does not say what this emblem was, its record of the organizational structure of the nation seems to indicate it, that it was a replica of the breastplate of the high priest. Now, the reason for Levi's use of this emblem becomes evident when we remember that the high priest was the active head of the whole tribe of Levi, both those who ministered in the religious life of the nation and those who ministered in civil affairs, and consequently, both the priesthood and the civil service carried out their duties under his direction and authority. Therefore, as the recognized insignia of his office and authority was the breastplate, so also those who worked under his direction would require a replica of his insignia to identify themselves and the authority that they derived from him. As described in the 28th and 39th chapters of Exodus, this breastplate consisted of a plate of pure gold, designed to be worn on the breast of the high priest. It was suspended from around his neck by two gold chains, fastened to two gold rings, inserted in its upper corners. In this plate were 12 openings in which were set 12 jewels, one jewel for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. For the reasons just noted, it seems certain that a replica of this breastplate was the emblem of the tribe of Levi. In support of this, the writer has before him a Jewish calendar for the year 1937-38, issued by the Messenger Corporation, on which the emblem of the tribe of Levi is shown as the breastplate of the high priest. As such, it was the emblem of both the priesthood and the civil service of ancient Israel. Now, some hundreds of years later, when King Solomon built the great temple in Jerusalem, this building and the area around it became, in effect, at least a separate community, a city within a city. Within this area, in addition to the temple itself, were the offices and the living quarters of the senior priests and civil servants. It was from these offices, therefore, that the whole nation was governed, both religiously and politically. Further, it was in the temple, situated in this enclave, that the national worship of God was conducted, and in it, too, the kings of the house of David were crowned and anointed in a great and solemn ceremony. The headquarters of both the civil and religious governments of the nation was administered by the tribe of Levi under the direction of the high priest. As the emblem of this tribe and of the high priest's authority was a replica of the breastplate, it followed that this emblem also became the emblem of the temple area, and as such it remained in use for about 400 years. Eventually, however, because of the failure of the Israel people to carry out God's will and purpose for them, the nation was divided, and then eventually both parts were conquered by their enemies, who burned Jerusalem and the temple, and then carried away the survivors as captives to distant lands. Though a small remnant of the house of Judah, called Jews, did later return, the great body of the people of both Israel and Judah never returned to Palestine, and so the Israel nation and the throne of David ceased to exist in Palestine. Nevertheless, the Bible repeatedly and emphatically declares that Israel would be regathered in a new homeland, and that a descendant of David would continue to reign over Israel forever. Obviously, then, the descendants of the Israel people of old must still exist in some other land, and the throne of David must have been transferred to and be reigning over at least a portion of them today. In view of this heraldic evidence already noted, pointing to the Israelitish origin of the Celto-Saxon people and the Davidic identity of our royal British house and throne, let us now consider the significance of the fact that the emblem of the tribe of Levi has a very prominent place among the emblems of certain British institutions. Some of them are very ancient. Now, as we saw, the emblem of the tribe of Levi became the emblem of an enclave within Jerusalem in which was the great building called the Temple of Solomon. In this building, an area around it, were the headquarters of both the religious and civil governments of Israel. Further, we saw that this great temple was the sacred place wherein all of the services of national worship were held, and in which the coronation services of the kings of the house of David took place. So again, let us note that the emblem of this separate area within Jerusalem was the emblem of the tribe of Levi as shown in illustration 236. Now, I might describe this for you. You may have seen pictures of a priest or of a man with a breastplate, but it's got four rows of three each, and each one of these is an opening that has a stone in it. It's a square plate, and it is suspended around the neck of the priest, and it's held both at the top and the bottom with gold chains, which holds it in place right on his chest. Now, this breastplate is also used today, for instance, in Canada. The emblem of the customs officials has this breastplate insignia on it, and it's also used in England in their customs shield or custom badge. So keeping this in mind, let us return our attention to Britain, the ancestral home of the main section of the Celto-Saxon family. There in London, just as in ancient Jerusalem, we see a distinct area or enclave. It's the royal borough of Westminster. And within this area, we see a great and ancient abbey, in which for 1,000 years or more, England's and then later Britain's national religious services have been held. Here too, for the same period of the kings of Britain's ancient line have been crowned and anointed in a ceremony, which, with the exception of Holy Communion, is similar to that which was used in the coronation of the kings of David's line in the temple in ancient Israel. Further, within this royal borough of Westminster, in which these things occur, and only a short distance from the abbey, are the Parliament buildings and the offices of the ministers of the crown, from which the nation is governed. Thus, just as it was in Israel of old, we have a capital city enclosing a separate area from which the nation is governed, and in which is an ancient abbey in which our sovereigns are crowned and all of our national religious services are held. This similarity is amazing, but it becomes even more so when we see that the emblem of the royal borough of Westminster is the same as that of the temple area in Jerusalem. It is the emblem of the tribe of Levi, the breastplate of the high priest of ancient Israel, and as we see in illustration 233, but in a horizontal position. We are aware, of course, that heraldic authorities call this emblem a portcullis because of its supposed resemblance to the iron gratings which were once used to strengthen the gates of castles and walled cities. And we're also aware of the claim that this emblem was adopted by Westminster from the Beaufort family. Both of these claims are open to serious doubt. If this emblem came from the Beauforts, then, or Beauforts, maybe that's Beauforts, I think that's Beauforts, then where did the Beauforts get it? And why would their emblem be chosen in preference to the emblems of other ancient and influential families? Further, why must it be assumed that because the emblems are the same, Westminster adopted its emblem from the Beauforts? The reverse is equally possible. The Beauforts could have adopted the emblem of Westminster. Actually, this question is not important because the available evidence clearly indicates that both Westminster and the Beauforts derived this emblem from a single and much older source, the Israelitish tribe of Levi. Now, with this in mind, let us turn for a moment to that pictorial record of the Norman conquest of England, which is called the Bayeux Tapestry, and there in some 230 feet of hand-embroidered pictures made in the years immediately after the Battle of Hastings, we have a record of the events of the invasion, and then a picture of the arms and the armor of those taking part in it. Now, our interest in this is that in the August 1966 issue of the National Geographic magazine, there are colored reproductions of several parts of the Bayeux Tapestry. On page 232 in the top left picture, and page 235 in the bottom left, there are suits of armor with some kind of breast covering, which was somewhat the appearance of the Westminster portcullis emblem. These appear to be rectangular in shape, have a border, and within the border are 12 objects which could be representations of the 12 stones of the breastplate. It may be, of course, that these are only a part of the knight's armor, but if they are actually replicas of the portcullis emblem, it follows that this emblem was in use long before the time of the Beauforts. In denying that the Westminster portcullis emblem is in any way derived from the emblem of Israel's high priest, some have pointed to the spikes at the bottom of the emblem as proof that it is nothing more than a representation of a portcullis as used in ancient castles as a means of defense at their gates. And they say that when the portcullis was lowered, these spikes were to go into the ground to make it more secure. As a matter of fact, however, these spikes were not a part of Westminster's ancient emblem, being nothing more than a heraldic embellishment added in modern times. The oldest known form of this emblem has no spikes, and I was assured of this by an official of the College of Heralds, with whom I discussed this very question. Further, a portcullis is made of iron, and in true heraldry would be shown as such, whereas in the grant of arms to Westminster, which only legalized the ancient usage of this emblem, it is definitely stated that the portcullis and its two chains and two rings are to be representations of gold. You'll see this in Butel's Heraldry in the 1966 edition. And here it should be noted that a grant of arms does not necessarily mean that the emblem mentioned in the grant was never previously used. On the contrary, those which appear in the earlier grants were almost certainly hereditary emblems which were already ancient when the practice of granting and recording arms first began. Another and very significant point is that whereas a real portcullis has a great many openings, the emblem of Westminster has only 12, which is the exact number of the openings in the breastplate emblem of the tribe of Levi. And we see, therefore, that except that its openings have no jewels, the emblem of Westminster is an exact replica of the emblem of the tribe of Levi. It is a plate, it is of gold, it has 12 openings, and it has two golden rings fastened, one each, to its upper corners, and to each of these rings is a golden chain attached. Earlier in this chapter, we noted that the emblem of the civil service of ancient Israel was also a replica of the breastplate of the high priest. In Britain, as in most other countries today, the customs or customs excise is one of the oldest and most important departments of the civil service. Note the emblem of Britain's Customs Service in illustration 237 is one of these portcullis. We're aware, of course, that there are those who will argue that the emblem of Westminster cannot be the emblem of the tribe of Levi because the openings in the so-called portcullis are empty. The jewels representing the 12 tribes of Israel are missing. Now, we will consider this point in a later chapter, but in the meantime, let us note that Britain is not the only country in which the portcullis is the emblem of the Customs Excise Department of the Civil Service. This is also true in Canada, but in this case, the openings in the portcullis are filled, as shown in illustration 238. In view of the evidence that we have presented herein, which clearly shows the emblem of Westminster to be identical with the emblem of the tribe of Levi, and in view of the identical circumstances of the use of this emblem in ancient Israel and in Britain, we must conclude that in it we have further evidence that the Israelitish origin and the identity of the Celto-Saxon people. Now that's chapter 13 of the book Symbols of Our Celto-Saxon Heritage by W.H. Bennett. Now what we're trying to do here is to find what happened to these Levites. We found previously that the tithe is to be paid to the civil service. It's to be paid to the Levites. We found that this is to be carried out forever. I pointed out to you that forever isn't up yet. Furthermore, there's another factor that comes into play as it relates here to the scripture, and it's this. In John 6:44, it says, "No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me, draw him, and I'll raise him up at the last day." In John 10:35, it says that the scripture cannot be broken. In Hebrews 13:8, we read, "Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever." In Titus 1, verse 2, we read, "Which God that cannot lie." In 2 Peter 1:20, we find that no prophecy of the Scripture is of any private interpretation. 2 Timothy 3:16 informs us that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. In Luke 4:4, we find that Jesus said, "It is written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." He said that as a direct citation from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, where Moses said that he might make you to know that man does not live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Eternal does man live. And in Malachi 3, verse 6, God tells us that I change not. And then finally in Matthew 5, verses 17 through 20, he said, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law or the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Because I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." Now when we take those 10 scriptures as a whole and put them together, we find that God doesn't change. We're to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Jesus didn't come to destroy the law. He came to fulfill it. The scripture can't be broken. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And God doesn't lie. No prophecy of the scriptures of any private interpretation. So it's not my interpretation. I didn't come here to say to you, for instance, that you ought to tithe because George Gordon tithes and it's a good idea, and besides that, your church needs the money. I've already gone through the scriptures and shown you that the tithe goes to the Levites, it never goes to the church, that the law is still in full force and effect, that the tithe encompasses more than just herds, flocks, and seeds. It encompasses everything, including your labor, and that's because God owns you and he owns all of the property on planet Earth. And furthermore, he went on to say, "I own all the property, including the earth, the heavens, and the heaven of heavens." And that the tithe is not an excise tax, it is a tax that's directly upon you. It's a tax on property, which is the exact opposite of the income tax, which is a tax, excise tax, or a tax on a privilege. Now, with that much in mind, let's take a look at one more factor that comes into play. And that is, how did we change our law from the tithing system to the income tax system? And we'll see that in 1 Samuel chapter 8 when we come back. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website, or all of these Law Hour programs, I should say, are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a question sent by a listener, of which I've received many, many of these, and ordinarily I will answer these one at a time when you send a question in. I look it up, I give you an answer, and I send it back to you, which I will do with this email here. But when I receive a number of these that all follow the same line, I get quite a few inquiries concerning tithing or Passover or some other subject, then it's worth putting it on the air and explaining it in detail, which is what we're doing here today. All right, Phil, now we've got a couple of more items that we need to cover. In the book here, Symbols of Our Celto-Saxon Heritage, let me see if I can help you find a copy of this book. Now, this book was first published in 1976 by W.H. Bennett. It was published in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. There was a second printing in 1985. I think if you went to your used bookstore and you said, I'd like to get a copy of Symbols of Our Celto, that's spelled C-E-L-T-O, hyphen Saxon Heritage, Celto-Saxon Heritage by W.H. Bennett, I'll just bet you that there's a copy or two of them out there in the world someplace. As I recall, the last time I looked this book up, it was $35. All right, now let's take a look at how this thing got started, this political slide, as they say in law, down the slippery slope, and that's in a book called Samuel. So if you flip over here, right past Deuteronomy, to Joshua, Judges, Ruth, we'll come to 1 Samuel chapter 8. Very short, plain chapter here. Let's just read it quickly. In chapter 8, verse 1, 1 Samuel. It says, it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abiah, and they were judges in Beersheba. Now Samuel's sons did not walk in his ways, but they turned aside after lucre, and they took bribes, and they perverted judgment. They were typical politicians of their day. Then all of the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and they came to Samuel and to Ramah, and they said unto him, Behold, you're old, and your sons walk not in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us, and Samuel prayed unto the Eternal. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Will hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto you, because they have not rejected you, Samuel, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all of the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto you. We pause right there. Nothing changed from 1000 B.C. when this event transpired until last night at 5 o'clock in the year 2006. We have the same bribe-taking, K Street lobbyists who are bribing our senators and representatives and probably bribing the president himself. They take lucre. Of course, we call these campaign contributions today, but they're bribes, plain and simple. And the people get real excited about that, and they get real upset about that. And you'll see with this Abramoff scandal that the senators and representatives now are scrambling to send the money back, to give the money to charity, and to pacify all of us. They're going to keep the same program going, but they're going to make some changes in the law so that they won't get caught as readily the next time. Now, that's what the bottom line is. Now, the reason I bring that to your attention is this is the background. This is what occurred 1000 B.C. And so the people, they came to Samuel. He was the chief judge. Be about the equivalent of coming to their chief justice of the Supreme Court, because that was Samuel's office. He was the chief judge. Now they said, we want a king like all the nations around us. God said to Samuel, when he brought the subject up to him, he said, look, they're not rebelling against you, Sam, they're rebelling against me. So boys and girls, we are the people who gave our God the finger and said, you stick it where there's no daylight, God, we're going to have a king like the Mongolians and like all the nations around us. Verse 9, he said, therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. So in verse 10, he describes for us, here's what's going to happen to you when you change your king from God to a king. Then you're going to change your law. When you change your king, you change your law. When you change your law, you change your king or your sovereign. So in verse 10, he warned him. He said, Samuel told all the words of the Eternal unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. We call this the draft. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariot. We call this the military industrial, they call that the military industrial complex. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries and to be cooks and to be bakers. And we now find that half the women of America are now working in the workforce. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. We call that distraint when the IRS takes your property. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. So he's going to take your tithe and shift it over to what we call an income tax, which is a whole lot more than a tenth, remember, today. But he's going to take that income tax for himself and for his officers. And he's going to take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. Now, we call that corporate America today. And today, our president said to us in the last election that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. And so, we don't call you bond servants anymore. We call you employees. Americans love it. It's bond servitude at its best. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. Now, we like to say in times past that elected officials were servants of the people. Today, you can rest assured that we, the people, are now the servants of our political establishment. In verse 18, he said, "You shall cry out in that day because of your king, which you shall have chosen you." This is democracy at its best. We get to choose our king every 4 years. And the Eternal will not hear you in that day. Which is why I've said to you before, you don't need to pray to Jesus about the political problems that we have today concerning George Bush. Because God's already told you, I'm not going to listen to that crap. In verse 19, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'Nay, but we will have a king over us.'" So even after God told them, "Now go back and think this over, you're making a bad mistake," the people came back to God and said, "Nevertheless, we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us, and go out before us and fight our battles." And Samuel heard all of the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Eternal. And the Lord said to Samuel, "You hearken unto their voice, and make them a king." And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, "Go ye every man into his own city." So from that day to this, boys and girls, we've had taxation. Now, the taxation from time to time gets to be worse and worse. We happen to be in a period of taxation where not only does the king tax us, but we have an alternative minimum tax, which now equals more than the original tax, for which our president gave us a tax relief package. Do you remember that? Okay, well, your taxes are higher now than they were then. And then it gets better than that. We now have a 10% inflation tax. 10% inflation tax. That's where the government just prints the money, puts it into circulation, and prices go up accordingly. And we all pay that 10% inflation tax, whether we like it or not. How do you like your king? It's time for us to wallow in it. It's what we wanted, and now we've got it. Now, the alternative to this, boys and girls, of course, was the tithes, and it still is to this day. Now, you owe an income tax. Let me show you that. It's over here in chapter, well, it's in Matthew, about chapter 17 and 22, as I recall. See if I'm about right. There's two places in here that talk about this thing of taxation. Let me get over here to Matthew chapter 22, I believe it is. Yeah, it's called Render Unto Caesar. It says in verse 15, "Then went the Pharisees, and they took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk, and they sent him to their disciples with the Herodians, saying, 'Master, we know that you are true, and you teach the way of God in truth. And neither care you for any man, for you regard not the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?'" Boy, that's a loaded question to this day, you know that? People will call me here at the law school. And about half of them are government agents. And the other half are just normal people that are confused about the income tax. And they will ask me, "Should you or do you advise your students to pay income tax?" And I get my information right here. Now, pay attention, because this is what Jesus told us. He said, Jesus perceived their wickedness, and he said, "Why do you tempt me, you hypocrites?" Verse 19, he says, "Show me the tribute money." and they brought him a penny. Now, if you're following along here, reach in your wallet right now and pull out a dollar bill. Can you do that? I'll just do that right here. I'll reach in my pocket, and I'll pull out a dollar bill. And here's George Washington right on the face of it. And at the top of this note, it says Federal Reserve Note, United States of America. And then at the bottom of George Washington's portrait, it says $1. All right. So I've got my Federal Reserve Note right here in front of me. Now listen to Jesus. He said, whose image and superscription do you see on this dollar bill? And I want you to note right at the top, it says Federal Reserve Note. This is not the currency of the United States. This is a note of a private corporation called the Federal Reserve, which was incorporated by the United States Congress in 1913. This is a private bank, a private consortium of international bankers. And this is their note. Now, note what it says here. In Matthew 22, verse 21, they said, it is Caesar's. All right? So on our face, we see, whose superscription do we see here? It's the Federal Reserve Note. Okay? And then he said unto them, then render unto the Federal Reserve the things which are the Federal Reserve's, and unto God the things which are God's. And when they heard these words, they marveled, and they left him, and they went their way. And that's what I tell people today. Same thing Jesus told them. Whose superscription do you find on that money? Now, the importance of using just weights and balances comes into play here. You owe your tithe to God, or you owe your tax to Caesar, one or the other, but you do not owe both. And Jesus told you over here in Matthew 6, I think it's verse 24. Let me just flip over here quickly. He said, no man can serve two masters. For either you will hate the one and love the other, or else you'll hold to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and mammon. Now, the Mormons do. So, I'm not sure, but what God made a mistake there. The Mormons can serve God and mammon. They can tithe and pay the income tax. And Jesus told you right here that, you know, you can't do that. You can't hold to one without despising the other and vice versa. So you should either, one, pay the income tax and forget tithing, or pay your tithe and forget the income tax. Don't pay both. Pay one God or the other, but don't pay both gods. And the reason is this. Number one, if you do not tithe, there's no penalty. Remember that? There's no penalty. God is not going to strike you dead with a lightning bolt in the morning because you did not pay your tithe. It is true, he will not open the windows of heaven and he will not give you any blessings. Can't blame him. You give him the finger, he's not very likely to give you your allowance. On the other hand, the other God will punish you. If you do not pay your income tax, the God of the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, France, and Denmark, they're going to punish you. They're going to lock you up in prison. They're going to fine you and take your house. They're going to take everything you've got by restraint. And that's why most people would prefer to pay the income tax and to satisfy bail than they would to pay the tithe and satisfy God. Can't blame them. Now, on the other hand, here in the United States, I can't speak for the rest of you people out there, but I can speak for here in our country, Congress does not assume to deal with non-taxpayers, and I believe you should stop being a taxpayer. I think you should stop having income. I think you should stop paying the income tax. Income is a criminal activity. Income tax is a criminal activity. It violates the law of God. But you know, it's like everything else in life, there's a choice for you to make. You got to make the choice. I'm not here to tell you what choice to make. I'm just here to give you the information. If you want to learn more, call and ask for my free CD package and we'll start you off and we'll say, well, this is the way the game is played. Here's the way this thing is done, then we have a tax school. And if you want to wean yourself off of the income tax, you can't work for Yellow Freight and IBM and General Motors. Those people deal in income. Those people pay you income for which you owe an income tax. I know the next question is, well, my God, then how are you going to live? And the answer is, very well. Thank you. All right, so a tenth then comes into play. Now, you'll notice here twice in verse 17 and in verse 15, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, God used the word tenth. In Proverbs 3, verse 9, we saw the word increase, first fruits, and substance. Now, a tithe is the counterfeit, or the income tax, I should say, is the counterfeit of a tithe. So the tithe has been counterfeited by the income tax. There's no penalty for not paying the tithe. There is a penalty for not paying the income tax if, in fact, you have income. If you'd stop having income, then you don't have to pay a penalty because you don't have any income. Now, there's a blessing that you receive in Malachi 3:8 for tithing. You don't get the blessing if you don't tithe. God told you he doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that the law hasn't changed, doesn't change, can never change, not so much as a jot or a tittle. The tithe is a tax on your increase, and it's not on your gross. So let's talk about that for a minute. If you're a laboring man, and you live in the city, and the preacher comes to you and says, well, you should pay your tithe on the gross. That's poppycock. Crazy on its face. The laboring man working for labor, working for wages, is just as much a businessman as a businessman who's out here buying, selling, and trading. And I pointed that out to you yesterday. If you're a businessman, you have a number of things that you have to pay. You know, you've got cost of goods sold. You've got utilities to pay. You got labor to pay and taxes to pay. There's all kinds of things that you've got to pay out of your gross. And the laboring man has the same thing. He's got transportation to and from work. He's got to pay rent on an apartment in the city. He has work shoes and work clothes that he has to buy in order for him to work. These are just as much cost of goods sold as it would be if you were a manufacturer and you were buying lumber to build furniture. So you should be reasonable and figure out, well, what are my cost of goods sold? Now, I live on a farm, and I produce my own food here, by and large. And so when I do that, I tithe on my food. I give 10% of it to poor people around me. Well, if you're living in the city and you don't produce any food, what you're producing is wages. You're producing money. You need to pay your tithe on the money that you earn. But you don't pay your tithe on the money that you earn on the gross, you pay it on the net. So when you get through paying your reasonable expenses that you would not have if you were out here living on the farm, producing your own food and fiber, then you come down to a number. And then that number should probably be around half. Probably around half. And remember this, if you're already paying the income tax, why would you want to tithe? I can't for the life of me see a guy that's paying income tax tithing. You're already tithing to Baal. If you're going to tithe to Baal, you can never overcome that criminal action. Tithing to Baal is an act of treason against your God. It's a violation of the first and second commandments, which say, you shall have no other gods before me. If you're going to worship the United States of America, why in the hell are you concerned about tithing? I mean, it's like a man who's robbing a bank and he's concerned about, did I put a quarter in the parking meter? What the hell difference does it make whether you violated the parking law while you're in the bank robbing it? If you're going to commit an act of treason against God by paying the income tax, and this act of treason violates the first and second commandments, which are capital felonies, and not tithing doesn't have a penalty, why would you be concerned about tithing? Beats me. Now, on the other hand, if you're sitting there saying, well, I'd kind of like to get in on the good times, I'd kind of like to make some money out of this, I would like to have the windows of heaven open and a blessing fall on me that I won't have room enough to receive it. Kind of reminds me of this Senator Harrison. Remember in the Abscam stings about 20 years ago? The FBI caught this guy. He was a senator from New Jersey, and he was in this office, and they paid him a $50,000 bribe. I mean, this guy was sticking money every place. He put it in his inside coat pockets. He put it in his jacket pockets. He put it in his pants pockets. He put it in his back pockets. He had so much money stacked up there on the desk, he didn't have places to put it all. He didn't think, I guess, that $50,000 was quite a bundle of money and that he might need a bag or an attaché case or something. And this is all caught now on videotape. Talk about funny now. This is a guy that had so much poured out on him, he didn't have places to put it. That's what God promised you. If you want to do that, then you're a prime candidate for my tax and business school. Let me show you how to do that. And we'll move you through the program and divorce you from the United States of America or Canada or Australia or New Zealand, whichever God you're serving, and then put you on a property, put you into property and dealing in property which isn't taxed here in the United States. Now, I can't speak for you Australians. I don't know what you do down there, but I guess we can look at it and figure it out. I suspect that your laws down there probably comport with the scriptural standards, just like they do here in the United States. Property has never been assessed or taxed here in the United States, and I don't think it has been in any other Anglo-Saxon country. So tuck that one away in your heart. Now, where do you physically send this tithe? I send it where the Levites send it. In other words, if the Levites, once they had theirs, they gave it to widows, orphans, and the poor. So why don't you give your tithe, if you're going to tithe, to widows, orphans, and poor? And if you need an organization to give it to, you could give it to the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, or some other institution. I just personally don't like those institutions because they typically spend more money raising funds than they do actually doing something with the funds that they raise. So I like to personally give it to somebody whose house burned down, somebody who's destitute in some way, or some old lady who's living on Social Security. We had an old man here, was in his 90s, 93 or 4 years old, living on $552 a month, I think, was the amount he was getting from his Social Security check. I just can't think of a better person to give that to than some old man or some old lady. That's what I do with my first tithe, since the Levites are no longer in operation. All right, so there's the story on tithing. I think we've pretty well exhausted the tithing story and given you the history and the background of it. Thank you so much, Phil, for sending the letter. That gave me something to talk about for a week. And tomorrow night we'll take up another topic. I don't know just what we'll do, and I'll find out something. So we'll see you tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about something. Don't know exactly what it'll be, but we'll figure it out. So let me give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.